Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our look at a brand new to us case. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you go to your favorite podcast app, leave a 5-star review, and follow the show. You can also go to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows and exclusive content, just as my first two Patreon supporters, Channel and Anthony, have done, as well as the largest monthly contributors, Samantha, Debbie, Betty, and Mark. Again, that's tinyurl.com/decastpatreon. All right, now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. If you've got to work, I hope this helps you get through the day. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. So this week, kind of by request, we are going back to Michigan, where we're going to take a look at the late 1960s series of slayings that became known as the Ypsilanti slayings, the Michigan murders, Ypsilanti Ripper, and the Coed Killer. Now, all of these crimes took place in the Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti region of Michigan between July of 1967 and July of 1969. And a man by the name of John Norman Collins, nay, Chapman, is eventually going to be arrested and convicted for one of these murders. However, getting to that point is a very long journey. Now, the first known victim disappeared on July 9th of 1967 from Ypsilanti, Michigan. Now, before we really dive into the meat of it, we need to kind of explain the area of Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti. They're both college towns, which means that there are a lot of transients in and out of the area. In Ypsilanti, there is Eastern Michigan University, which at the time of this murder had an estimated 13,000 students, while Ann Arbor is the home of the University of Michigan, which during this period was estimated to have roughly 40,000 students attending. Now, to July 9th, a 19-year-old student who also worked at the college by the name of Mary Teresa Flezar left the apartment that she shared with a fellow student and was not seen again. The 9th was a Sunday. The following morning, Monday the 10th, Mary's roommate contacts one of her sisters because Mary had not shown up for the job that both women shared at the field services office at Eastern Michigan University. From the roommate, this sister, who is younger than Mary by 1 year, learns that Mary had gone out the previous evening to get some air and not come back. Now, this sister was immediately suspicious as she had made plans with some friends to go to a nearby lake the previous day, and Mary had said she was going to join them. However, Mary never showed up, so the sister had actually gone to the apartment at around 7:30 with these friends to find Mary's roommate and boyfriend there, but no Mary. The sister ends up staying for a short period of time, but eventually gives up and asks the roommate to have Mary call her as soon as she gets in. From speaking to this roommate, Mary's sister learns that Mary had returned home about 15 to 20 minutes later, and after staying in the apartment for a short period of time, had decided to go out and go for a walk, after which point she was not seen again. Mary's sister contacts her mother, who then heads to the apartment that Mary had lived in at 413 Washtenaw Avenue. According to police reports, Mary's mother stated that upon arriving at the apartment, she noticed immediately that her daughter's car, which Mary's father had purchased for her only a short time before, was not in its normal parking space, but was in fact parked on the opposite side of the parking lot. So Mrs. Fleiser Parks uses a key that her daughter had given her to access the apartment and goes inside. Questioned later by police, Mary's mother stated that she had a key as she liked to drop by the apartment on occasion to see how her daughter was doing, as well as to bring over any supplies that Mary and her roommate might need. Mrs. Fleiser noticed upon accessing the apartment and going through it that none of her daughter's belongings seemed to be missing. At this point, Mrs. Fleiser contacts the field services office, where she speaks to Mary's roommate and learns that Mary has not yet shown up. Mary's mother then asks the roommate what her daughter had last been wearing, and the roommate informs her that Mary had been wearing a orange sundress with polka dots and a pair of sandals. Miss Fleiser thanks the roommate, gets off the phone, goes and looks in Mary's closet, and notices that, yes indeed, this dress her daughter had been wearing is missing, as are a pair of shoes. The mother looks around again and notices that both her daughter's car keys as well as her apartment keys are missing. Although, upon inspecting her daughter's purse, Mrs. Fleiser notes that her wallet and driver's license are still there. Upon finding this, Mary's mother contacts her husband, who is working as a mechanical engineer. The Fleiser family was a fairly large family from nearby Willis. They lived on a farm. Mary was the second born of 7 children total. The firstborn daughter, who was described as studious and homey, she seemed like your atypical mid-1960s wallflower type girl. She was very well regarded by her friends and family, whom even to this day have a website running dedicated to Mary's memory. Now, the Fleiser family was a very religious family and extremely tight-knit. So upon learning that his daughter was missing, Mary's father tells his wife that she should contact the Ypsilanti police immediately and then head over to the police department, and that he will leave work and meet her there, which is exactly what ends up happening. Now, both of Mary's parents would later state that they were frustrated upon arriving at the Ypsilanti Police Department, as the officer working the desk as well as his immediate supervisor basically stonewalled them, telling them that it's the late 1960s, you know, there's a counterculture going on in America, and it is not unheard of for college-age students to go off on a whim only to return a day or even a few weeks later with tales of some grand adventure that they had embarked on. However, Mary's parents know their daughter. They know that she is a very homey and studious young woman, and that even had she decided to go off on some adventure, she would not have done so without taking her belongings, as well as informing her family of her intentions and of where she was going. The Ypsilanti Police Department, however, are not hearing this, even when Mary's parents pushed the issue, stating that she would not have left her car behind to go off on, you know, God knows what, and that they needed to look into it. The police pushed the issue pretty hard that the family needs to go home and wait for their daughter to return and or make contact with them, which is exactly what the Visor family does. And Mary's parents would later state to reporters that as the parents sat in the living room that evening, her father suddenly realized that his daughter was dead, that they were never going to see her alive again. He said that he looked over at his wife, who looked at him back and perhaps realized what it was that he had been thinking. Neither of them said anything, as they were a very stoic family. It was just one of those things that they knew to be true, and that as hard as it was, they were going to get through it without any of the emotional trauma that so often devastates families in situations such as this. By all accounts, the family kept it together publicly, with the Fallizers contacting the police the next day, the 11th, and the police continuing to push back, saying, look, you need to wait until, you know, something happens. Your daughter's going to come back. However, the Fallizers were not to be deterred, and the next day, the 12th, they finally succeeded in getting the police to actually take a missing persons report on their 19-year-old daughter. And this is what they end up putting out. Missing girl, Mary Therese Fallizer, 413 Washtenaw Avenue, Ypsilanti, white female, 19 years old, date of birth 12/4/47, height 5 feet 2, 104 pounds, dark brown short hair, green eyes, wears glasses, was wearing orange colored polka dot sundress when last seen, missing since 7/9/67 after she left apartment to go for a walk. Nothing is done on the 12th concerning her missing persons case other than putting out this notice. However, the following day, a veteran detective of the Ypsilanti Police Department is assigned the case, and he immediately begins looking for Mary. And the detective would later state that almost immediately upon receiving the file and making contact with the family, he realized that almost certainly something very bad had come to this girl, as just from speaking to her family, learning about Mary, it became apparent to him almost instantly that she was not the type of young woman who would just go off on a lark. Mary enjoyed staying at home, staying at the apartment, playing her guitar, spending time with friends and family. And fairly quickly, this detective is able to piece together what had taken place on Sunday, July 9th of 1967. Mary had gotten up around 6:30, showered, dressed, and left the apartment, going to St. John's Church shortly after the start of the 7 o'clock Mass. After this, Mary had walked to the university, stopping to get a cup of coffee along the way before arriving at her job at the field services office shortly after 8 a.m. That day, the field services office was fairly busy. Basically, they were responsible for registration of students for various activities. Now, at some point, either while she was at work or shortly after leaving work, Mary's younger sister called to ask if she wanted to go up to Silver Lake with her, a cousin of theirs, and a man that Mary had previously dated. Mary agreed to meet the trio there later that day. Mary intended to go to Silver Lake, bringing her guitar with her, and while she wouldn't be able to swim on this particular occasion due to being on her period, she thought that it would be fun to hang out with the three of them, play her guitar, and just enjoy a lazy Sunday afternoon. Now, according to interviews conducted by this detective, Mary arrived at Silver Lake at somewhere around 5 p.m., only to find that the local state troopers had closed the park to further admission, meaning that Mary would not be able to join her sister and the other two individuals. And instead, Mary decided to drive to Half Moon Lake, which was, give or take, 6 miles to the west of Silver Lake. The officer deduced that Mary may have done this under the belief that her sister had not been able to gain access to Silver Lake and had simply decided to move on down the road to Half Moon Lake, which was significantly smaller and nowhere near as crowded. In any event, Mary ends up at Half Moon Lake, walks around trying to find her sister, cousin, and former boyfriend, and eventually stumbles across a man that she had gone to high school with. After speaking with this young man for a few moments and learning that he had not seen Mary's sister, Mary decides to simply plunk her down and play her guitar. This young man, who was working as a lifeguard, stated that he saw Mary go over to a boat that was beached on the shore and begin playing. A small group of children had gathered around, although eventually, as the afternoon grew later, these children end up dispersing, and at roughly 7:30, there were very few people left at the lake. This young man said that he began to stow items for the night, and that the last he had seen of Mary, she was heading back towards the parking lot. Her movements after this are unknown for a period of time. We do know that Mary ends up back at her apartment in Ysplanty at some point after 8 o'clock, that her roommate and boyfriend were there, at which point Mary learns that her sister and companions had been there a short period beforehand looking for Mary. The trio having been unaware that Silver Lake had become so congested that it had been closed to new traffic. Now, the roommate's boyfriend was described as something of an arrogant asshole, a gruff individual who seemed to walk around the apartment as though he owned it. However, everyone questioned about this man stated that they did not believe he was responsible for Mary's disappearance. Mary appears to have stayed at the apartment for a short period of time before deciding that she was going to go out and go for a walk. Officers thought initially that Mary's roommate and her boyfriend were the last people to have seen Mary alive. However, as they broadened their search and began questioning people in the surrounding community, they learned that this was not in fact the case, and that multiple individuals had seen Mary or somebody resembling her after she left the apartment. At about 8:45, a campus police officer that was patrolling the cross street perimeter of the university informed police that he had seen a young woman bearing Mary's description walking on the opposite side of the street towards Hamilton Avenue. This officer also told the police that he was familiar with the young woman as her car had stalled out at one point on the campus and he had given her aid, but that he had also seen her around the campus and knew her as someone who worked somewhere on the school grounds. Although, after this brief sighting, he did not see Mary again. However, an individual that was familiar with Mary informed the police that he had seen her and had witnessed an extremely strange interaction. This individual was at his home on Hamilton Street between Emmett and Washtenaw. He worked with one of Mary's uncles at a factory in Ypsilanti, and because of this, the two of them had become somewhat familiar to the point that they would usually exchange pleasantries if they encountered each other in the community. This man informed police that he had watched as Mary walked by on the opposite side of the road from his house, and that a blue-gray Chevrolet had driven down the street, the driver of which he described as a young, clean-cut man. The car pulled to the side of the road, and although he could not hear what was said, the witness stated that it appeared the man was speaking to Mary through the passenger side window. Mary had shaken her head at the man, at which point the car had taken off down the street, turning onto Washtenaw as Mary resumed her walk. The man continued watching, and a few moments later, the exact same car had come flying down the street, heading in the direction of Mary. And at this point, the driver had cut in front of Mary, blocking her path, and it appeared to the witness that the man was trying to coerce her into his vehicle. However, Mary again refused. The witness stated that Mary had walked around the rear end of the vehicle and continued on her way, at which point the car had backed out of a driveway that it was partially blocking and then taken off down the street past Mary at a high rate of speed. This witness said that he was extremely anxious after having witnessed this, and he kept an eye on Mary until she reached the corner of Washtenaw Avenue, at which point he lost sight of her. So based with this information, the police start asking around more, trying to locate this vehicle. However, given the description of the car that the second witness had seen, they are unable to do so. Now, the police continue with their investigation, determined to try and discover what has happened to Mary. They are fairly certain that she has become deceased, and that whoever was responsible for it, more likely than not, was the driver of this car. Officers check Mary's vehicle, searching it fairly thoroughly, although they are unable to discover any form of forensic evidence that will be valuable to their case. One thing they do learn, however, is that Mary had a very unique necklace. Mary had attended Expo 67, which was a World's Fair that was held in Montreal, Quebec, Canada, from April 28th to October 29th of 1967. And while there, she had picked up a Canadian silver dollar necklace that she wore on a fairly regular basis. According to her family, Mary never took this necklace off. It was not found in her apartment. This is a piece of holdback information that the police are not going to release, in the hopes that should they be able to find Mary, they will find this necklace, or barring that, they will be able to locate this necklace at some point, and it will lead them to the discovery of Mary's killer. So officers continue to doggedly pursue Mary's case as her family comes to the realization that she's not coming back. They remain calm and in constant contact with law enforcement, hoping for some development in their loved one's case. However, weeks pass with very little being gleaned concerning Mary's disappearance and presumed murder. Officers even reach out to Canadian authorities under the belief that Mary may have been taken up into their jurisdiction and murdered. However, officers to the immediate north state that they have found no young women, be it alive or dead, matching the description of Mary. However, they do learn that Mary had an encounter with an individual the prior month, June, when she and her sisters had gone up to Expo 67 and on the way back had stopped at a restaurant to eat. One of the waiters there, a young man who took something of a fancy to Mary, had ended up giving Mary his address, and the two of them had promised to write one another. However, after locating and speaking to this young man, it was deduced that while he had a little interest in Mary, he had not taken any efforts to contact her. And in fact, on the date of her disappearance, he had an alibi that was unshakable. During this period of time, officers received a number of promising leads concerning Mary. However, unfortunately, none of them panned out. On August 2nd, Mary's father and oldest brother returned to Ypsilanti and retrieved her car, unaware that the detective who had been assigned to Mary's case was so dedicated to it, as he himself had a girl around Mary's age. He had begun searching in wooded areas and in and around lakes in Ypsilanti during his free time. All of this changed on August 7th. Two boys were working on a tractor in Superior Township, which was north of Ypsilanti. The property was largely abandoned, as the family that owned it had purchased a new piece of farmland in Saline. And while there was a house on this piece of property, it had been abandoned since the family had moved away. Now, these two young boys, one of whom was a member of the family that owned the property, were out in the cornfield working on a tractor that had broken down. The house that was on this property was known as a place where young people would come in order to spend time together without prying public eyes or the eyes of their parents. And as these two young boys worked on this tractor, they later told police they heard a car pull up out in front of the house. Thinking that it was a young pair of lovers come to use the facilities, they decided to go over and be peeping Toms. However, as they drew near to the house, they heard a car door slam shut and then a car go racing off down the road. Curious as to what was going on, the boys rounded the front of the house and saw dust still lingering in the air on the other side of the street, as well as a pair of tire tracks. We will be back in just a moment. You've heard me talk about it before, peeps and freaks. Chinese Mandarin is the number one in-demand language globally in the international job market. And I have a brand new sponsor this week just for you. Chinese teacher Mary. Mary goes deep into learning Mandarin, much the same way I go deep into covering true crime cases, ensuring that every single student not only understands pronunciation and sentence structure, but that they can differentiate between tones, read the language, and speak it fluently. I have never come across another Chinese teacher quite like Mary, because while she likes to have fun, and believe me, Mary is absolutely hilarious, she takes the job of teaching foreigners Chinese extremely seriously. So what I want you to do right now is go to tinyurl.com/ChineseTeacherMary, follow her, subscribe to her, come to her class, which is held 3 times a day. Support her and learn from her. Because I can almost guarantee you that after one lesson with Mary, you're going to realize that there is not a single teacher out there who is as dedicated to teaching as she is. Again, that's tinyurl.com/ChineseTeacherMary. Or just look for the link in the description. Hey there, D&Ders, your friend Ian here with another brand new sponsor this week. Artwork by Katie. Now, as the son of a fairly successful artist, I grew up around the art world, saw many different styles of art. I know good art from bad, and I can honestly say that in addition to being a good friend, Katie is one of the best artists I have ever had the pleasure of seeing. Her works of art, be it drawings or paintings, are absolutely amazing. And Katie doesn't just do original works of art, she also does commission pieces. So if you're looking for that perfect piece of art to offset the decor in your home, office, or even in your place of business, go check out Artwork by Katie at linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. That's linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. You'll be blown away. The tire tracks led from the road into thick weeds on the opposite side of the road from the house. Obviously, the boys are curious as to what just transpired, so they cross the road and head off into the woods. The boys later told officers that upon getting into the woods about 20 feet, they noticed an extremely rank smell and believed that and the individual who had been driving the car may have gotten rid of a dead animal or something, although given the stench of it, they knew from experience that the animal was almost certainly in an advanced state of decomposition, and they couldn't understand why someone would hold on to the body of an animal for so long before getting rid of it. And it's at this point that they decide to continue on further into the weeds to see just what exactly transpired. And eventually they come to a clearing in the road. There, in a pile of trash, the boys see a large black shape crawling with flies, and it's from this shape that the smell that they noticed was coming. And the boys are unable to tell whether or not what they're seeing is an animal or a human body. They told officers it appeared that the end of each limb had been severed, making it impossible for them to discern whether or not the thing had hands and feet or hooves. And it's at this point that the boys decide that they should probably contact law enforcement, as this is really strange. The boys leave the farm and head to Ypsanti, where they locate the local state police barracks and inform the officer on duty at the desk of what they have encountered. Naturally, the officer is believing that the boys may be playing a prank of some kind or had simply been spooked by seeing this animal carcass. However, the officer later stated something about the boys' demeanor told him that this was important, so he contacts the detective bureau inside of the police barracks. One of the detectives goes down and speaks to the boys and returns a short time later to inform his partner that whatever it is that these boys have discovered, he believes the two of them need to go and investigate it. The detectives drive the two boys back to Superior, at which point the boys show them what it is they have found in the woods, and very quickly both officers realize that this is not, in fact, a dead animal, but is almost certainly the body of a deceased person. However, because of the advanced state of decomposition, they were unable to determine a sex at this point. The detectives contact the station house and let them know what they have discovered, and after a short period of time, multiple officers descend on the scene, and as they wait for the medical examiner to arrive, they begin searching the immediate vicinity in the hopes of finding something of evidentiary value. They also ask the barracks to search any recent missing persons cases in the hopes that they may be able to link this body up to an individual. One of those individuals who arrives on scene is the detective working Mary's case. This officer later stated that upon arriving at the scene, he had a gut feeling that this was, unfortunately, the body of Mary, but that he could not be certain until he located the orange polka dot sundress that Mary had last been seen wearing. So with that in mind, he started searching desperately to find something, anything that would either prove or disprove his feeling. While this is all going on, the medical examiner, Dr. H.A. Scoville, arrives. Scoville examines the body and informs the officers that he believes that the body is that of a female, although he's unable to determine the age or anything else of evidentiary value. The medical examiner orders that the body be removed to the University of Michigan Medical Center in Ann Arbor, where an autopsy will be performed the next day. So with the body gone from the scene, the officers continue their search of the crime scene, and eventually they find a sandal in the woods. And upon seeing it, the detective working Mary's case immediately realizes that his fears are true. He contacts other detectives at the Ypsanti Police Department and asks them if they will go over and speak with the Flezer family to inform them that, unfortunately, they more likely than not have located their daughter and that she is deceased. However, officers do not give up on their search of the crime scene. Officers assumed, rightly so, that the body had been there for some period of time and had been moved a number of times just based on the evidence that they found when the body was discovered. There was drag marks in the dirt and trash that was piled up around the body. There was also evidence, as was later learned, that the victim was nude at the time of discovery, that the feet and one hand were missing, and there were multiple stab wounds on the torso. Now, as the search continues of the crime scene, the officer assigned to Mary's case, along with another officer, drives out to the Flezer home with the sandal in tow, and upon speaking with Mary's parents and showing them the sandal, they get a tentative identification that this is, in fact, the body of Mary that has been discovered. Mary's father asks if they can see the body. However, he is stalled by one of the detectives, who states that until they have a positive ID, nothing can be released. However, they ask that Mary's family get Mary's dental records, and Mary's family ends up turning over the names of two dentists that Mary had seen in the previous few years, who are able to pull up Mary's dental records and get them over to the University of Michigan Medical Center. News of this discovery quickly spreads, and by the time that the officers arrive back at headquarters, reporters are already waiting. A brief press conference is given where officers only state that a body has been found in Superior Township. It appears to be that of a female, although they have few other details that they can share with the press at this point. The following morning at 9:15 a.m., this was August 8th, the autopsy is performed. They find that it is a young woman, age estimated at around 20 years old. There are roughly 20 lacerations to the chest and abdomen, with 20 of these lacerations having come from a knife or other sharp object. The feet, which is already discussed, are missing, and it's determined that they had been purposefully severed, as was one of the hands. However, the left hand is still there, although many of the fingers are missing, and it's believed that these have been the victim of animal predation. Also, it's discovered that the lower ends of the tibia and fibias are shattered, and the left fourth metacarpal bone fractured, as well as linear abrasions on both the chest and torso, which indicate to the pathologist that the victim had been beaten. by mid-morning of the 8th, it is confirmed that the body is that of Mary Flezer. This is done through dental examinations. Obviously, Mary's family is informed of this. Again, her father asks to see the body and is informed by detectives that it is probably not a good idea for them to see her, as they should probably remember Mary as they had last seen her alive and happy. Also that same morning, officers continued with their search of the crime scene, and it's during this search that an officer moves a piece of corrugated metal and discovers a horrific sight beneath it, a pile of women's clothing. This is, in fact, the sundress and underpants that Mary had been wearing. It's determined that Mary's dress had been cut down the front and that her underwear had been forcefully ripped from her body, meaning that more likely than not, Mary had been sexually assaulted either prior to or after her murder. Now, generally speaking, during this point in time, this area of Michigan really didn't get a lot of homicide cases, especially ones that were so obviously vicious and brutal. So news of the discovery of Mary's body quickly spreads like wildfire. So now, not only do detectives have the family to consider as they begin this now definite homicide investigation, they also have the press as well as the local residents breathing down their neck, watching their every move to see if they're going to be able to discover what in fact happened to Mary. Officers continued the investigation of the crime scene, and it's determined that initially Mary's body had lain upon a pile of trash. However, it was moved roughly 5 feet away into a field where it had lain for some period of time before being moved further again, another 3 feet. They believed that this was most likely the result of the killer returning to the scene of the crime and moving the body for reasons unknown. The next day, August 9th, the police release Mary's body to her family. Her remains are transported to a funeral home in Ypsilanti, where the funeral director has arranged a special coffin which will be double locked and permanently sealed. Now, this is important because something is going to happen that leads investigators to believe that the killer is not only a local individual, but is also paying attention to the news reports concerning Mary's disappearance and discovery. The next day, the 10th, Mary's parents are preparing to leave for the funeral home when a phone call comes in from one of the detectives working Mary's case. He asks the family whether or not they know anyone who drives a bluish-gray Chevy. Mary's parents respond that they don't know anyone who drives such a vehicle, and were given a description of the individual driving it, a young man around 20 years of age. They say that this description does not fit anyone that they can think of at the moment who was in Mary's current circle of friends. The officer then goes on to recount to the family that earlier that morning, A young man matching this description had arrived at the funeral home and requested to take a picture of Mary's body, stating that it was at the request of her family. When informed that he would not be able to take such a picture, the man responded somewhat haughtily, quote, "You mean you people can't fix her up enough so I could just get one picture of her?" When informed for a second time that this would not be possible, the man had stormed from the funeral parlor, at which point the individual who had encountered them informed the funeral director of what had just happened. The funeral director in turn contacted the police, who then contacted Mary's family after speaking with the individual who had encountered this suspicious person. Which, depending upon which source you are taking the information from, was either the receptionist at the funeral home or a handyman who was working at the funeral home. In either case, the individual was not able to give the police any sort of concrete description of the individual, save that they were not carrying a camera that they noticed when they spoke to this man. Given the description of this person, as well as the witness who had seen a bluish-gray Chevy driven by a young man pull up onto Mary twice on the night of her disappearance, both her family and detectives jumped to the conclusion that this individual was more likely than not the person responsible for Mary's disappearance and murder. The Flazer family ends up putting their daughter Mary to rest on Saturday, August 12th. The funeral services were attended by numerous police officers who were hoping that the individual who had come to the funeral parlor looking to take photographs of Mary's body might turn up at her funeral. However, no one matching the physical description or driving a car similar to that scene showed up at Mary's funeral, and the officers were left frustrated as they had nothing to go on at this point. A few days after this, on August 16th, the police sent out a bulletin. Cancel missing girl, cancel WCTBC 30268 YPSIPD TT737 7/12/1967 Mary Therese Flizer. Now, unfortunately, with the scant evidence that officers have, very little in the way of headway is made in Mary's case. And by the winter of 1967, Mary's case is going to be placed into the inactive file inside the state police barracks, as no new information has come in, nor have any leads come in that have led them to anything of importance. And eventually, Mary's murder is going to kind of fall from the public consciousness, as no new crimes are reported, nor are any further missing persons reports of a similar nature discovered to have taken place within the county. That is, until the following summer, in July of 1968, which is where we are going to pick this case up next week. I hope that you guys have enjoyed our first look at the Ypsilanti Ripper, and that you'll consider becoming a Patreon member over at tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive series. Also hope you guys will check out this week's sponsors, Chinese Teacher Mary and Katie, my artist friend, both of whose links can be found in the description for this week's show. All right, until next time, stay morbid!